Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stuart Pack, Attorney Registration Number 6779. In this matter, I'm representing the appellant David I. Barron. Mr. Barron is asking this court to implement longstanding and well-accepted Colorado law in the areas of breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, and misrepresentation. This law required the law firm of Moy Wright to disclose all material information that was necessary in equity and good conscience to be disclosed so that its client, Mr. Barron, could make an informed decision as to selection and retention of counsel. And in order to make the facts already disclosed to Mr. Barron not misleading, Mr. Barron is not asking this court to announce any new rule of law or extend any existing rule of law. And in that same vein, Mr. Barron is asking this court to impose fee forfeiture as the remedy for Moy Wright's breach of duty of loyalty and good faith. That concept has been accepted in the state of Colorado since at least 1990 in the case of Moore and Company versus Tall, which is cited in our briefs, as well as the concept having been accepted by the Supreme Court also in Mullins versus Hanson Hendrickson in 2002 by reference to Section 37 of the Restatement Governing Lawyers.
Mr. Pack, let me interrupt you for a second and ask you about your statement that you're not asking us to adopt a new rule of law. I mean, of course we have case law saying that lawyers owe a fiduciary duty to their clients, but it seems like there isn't any case law on the issue of whether in this situation lawyers have a duty to disclose issues about their disciplinary history or arrest history or medical issues. Is that correct?
It is correct, Your Honor, in those in these precise terms that you asked it. However, the concept, first of all, there was no private medical information here because of the way the disciplinary rules are framed. Attorney A went forward with a conditional admission, all of that information became public and was known, and that was the fact was known to both Moy Wight and Attorney A. And more importantly, the issue here is not so much the state suspension, but the underlying conditions that affected and were ongoing with Attorney A, namely alcoholism, clinical depression, a criminal record, domestic violence convictions. Those are the underlying conditions that the client, Mr. Barry, had a right to know. Those were material information.
Counsel, let me stop you there with the ongoing conditions that you just raised. How was he actually prejudiced in this case, despite the ongoing conditions that you just described? How did it affect the performance of his counsel?
Well, we really don't know, because Mr. Barron wasn't given the opportunity to make an assessment contemporaneously as to how Attorney A performed. There were some strange things that Attorney A did during the representation, but they were out of context and could be ascribed to human error, let's say. Or the fact that someone might have been having a bad day.
Which is basically what the trial court found, right? I mean, the trial court did not ascribe any bad performance to Attorney A as a result of these ongoing conditions that you just described.
And that is the error that the trial court made, and that is the precise distinction between a case in which a client is seeking compensatory damages, which is not this case, and a case in which the client is pursuing fee forfeiture, which does not require proof of actual harm or causation. And we have cited in our briefs numerous cases, as well as Colorado case law, specifically the Mullins case, to the effect that the purpose of the fee forfeiture remedy is to protect the sanctity of the attorney-client relationship. It is not intended to compensate the client for any damage, because sometimes attorney misconduct, the damage that flows from that is very difficult to ascertain. Also, the purpose of fee forfeiture is to act as a deterrent and a sanction, as the Minnesota Supreme Court has said, to agent disloyalty and misconduct. And so that was the primary error that the trial court made here, is by looking at this from the point of view of the impairment or non-impairment, or the degree, the qualitative or quantitative nature of that impairment, as opposed to looking at the client's rights. What we're arguing is that Mr. Barron, as a client, as a consumer of legal services, if you will, had the right to be fully informed of all material information that Moy White knew about Attorney A. And Moy White deliberately withheld that information, even though it knew most of that information was going to become public in the very near future. And so that's the distinction between why it doesn't really matter, Your Honor, whether or not Mr. Barron was actually harmed or prejudiced. The principle that's being upheld here is that attorneys owe a duty of loyalty and good faith to their clients. And when they breach that, just like in the Moore case, when a real estate agent breached that duty, the real estate agent wasn't entitled to receive his commission. And we're saying, how much more so is that to be the case with regard to the very highest of all fiduciary duties in the law, that of the attorney-client privilege, attorney-client relationship, excuse me. So that I think is the answer to your question about, that's my attempt to respond to your question.
Thank you.
So, I understand your response. Because the attorney A problem was not disclosed, even though there's no damage shown, as we understand damages, that the a punishment should be required, and that punishment requires a sanction in the form of money. Is that correct?
Well, it's a sanction in the form of a forfeiture of the fee. In other words, an agent that breaches its fiduciary duty to its principal is not entitled to profit from that disloyalty. And so why I use the word sanction, because that's the word that some of the courts have used, it is really an attempt to fulfill a longstanding principle of agency, that an agency that breaches the duty of loyalty takes nothing from that misconduct. That's really what is going on here. That's what we're asking the court to do. And the Mullins case, in a footnote, cites with approval Section 37 of the restatement, which precisely authorizes the forfeiture of some or all of the fees for a serious and clear breach of fiduciary duty. And I don't think there could be anything that is more clear or serious than not telling your client everything about the lawyer who's going to be working on your case, especially when the problems are in the very, very recent past and are not resolved. They're unstable. Moy White did not even tell Mr. Barron that Attorney A was subject to ongoing treatment and monitoring, nor did Moy White tell Mr. Barron that it had information that 30% of attorneys with problems similar to Attorney A relapsed within 5 years.
Mr. Pack, Judge Bronfen said here that if there were a duty to disclose, the contours of it would seemingly be very broad, because any time a lawyer was going through a divorce or had death in the family or had stress from some other cause, that the lawyer might be required to disclose that to the client. Do you agree with that? And if not, what limits would you put on the contours of a duty here?
Well, I think I don't agree with Judge Bronfen in that regard. I think the contours are what would a reasonable law firm disclose, and what would be material to a client. And the concept of materiality is certainly not a new one in the law. We cited any number of cases that say that if it's a fact which would be important to a person in making his or her decision on an important matter, then it's material. And so I think that would be a question of fact, a jury question, for a court or a jury to decide. And so I think that we're not asking for anything that's open-ended. I guess we're asking for the court to set up a rule that lets the finder of fact make that decision in every case. Again, the thing that's crucial here is this was not private information, and this was information that was even more so to be disclosed because of the touting memo of November 8th, 2009, in which Moy White lauded and touted the credentials, the skill, experience of Attorney A, but did not tell the other side of the story. And there are specific restatement sections that say that that's a misleading statement when you tell half of the truth. And it's just as much a lie as if they had misrepresented the law school that Attorney A went to.
Mr. Pack, I have another question to ask you. It seems that there's an anomaly in your position and what you said this morning in terms of, on the one hand, saying that there was a duty to disclose, and on the other hand, telling us that all this information was became public as soon as the suspended the state suspension was announced. So how can there be a duty to disclose information that's otherwise available to the public?
Well, the information was available to the public. However, Moy White deliberately sabotaged that that effort by the very email that I told you about, the November 8, 2009 email, which said only laudatory things about this attorney, and in essence distracted and put Mr. Barron off from making a more careful search, a search that there are probably very few clients make of the Supreme Court's disciplinary records when they hire an attorney.
Well, if Moy White had not sent that email, presumably Mr. Barron still would have had no incentive to look to or to do research to see if there are any disciplinary proceedings against any of the attorneys that were working for him.
Exactly so. And so that's what makes their conduct even more egregious, because by sending that email, they even they threw sand in his eyes in this sense by not telling me the whole truth. I agree with you. If they hadn't gone that far, then Mr. Barron certainly wouldn't have looked. But having received such a laudatory recommendation from the very lawyer that Mr. Barron hired, Mr. Liebman, to work out the case, that kind of made the trail go cold. And so he didn't look until long afterwards. But it wasn't for him to have to look. It should have been disclosed at the outset by Moy White. That was their duty to do that, not to hope that Mr. Barron will find out somehow on his own initiative. That's not what the law requires. That's not the duty of loyalty. I think at this point I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Unless there are further questions.
Very well. You can reserve the rest of your time. Thanks, Mr. Pack.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Carolyn Fairless, attorney registration number 30214. With me at council table is my colleague, Kendra Beckwith, and we represent the appellee, Moy White. May it please the court. Mr. Barron is asking this court to impose a new rule of law that no court has adopted that would ignore the factual findings that were made by the trial court, that would impose an unworkable standard on lawyers and their clients, and that would in fact harm the public. For two reasons, this court should refuse that request. Number one, there is no materiality and there is no causation. Mr. Barron is asking this court to rewrite the factual findings that were made by the trial court. The trial court specifically found that Mr. Barron's testimony regarding the Attorney A matter was not credible. He found that it was manufactured for trial, and he found that it was entitled to no weight. Those credibility determinations are unassailable on appeal, and they are fatal to Mr. Barron's claim that this information was material to him, or that there was any causation that may have been caused by the failure to disclose. Mr. Barron is essentially asking this court to hold that any attorney who has any issue going on in his or her personal life, especially if they have a diagnosis, has to wear a scarlet letter on their chest. and for some indeterminate period of time disclosed to every client the fact that they have this personal issue.
Now, Mr. Pack talked about half-truths in his brief, also discussed cases that talk about half-truths. Where does Moy White fit into this, given the Memorandum A, which talked in glowing terms about Attorney A, but failed to say anything negative about him?
There was no half-truth, either as a factual matter, Your Honor, or as a legal matter. Judge Bronfen specifically found, and in fact it was conceded in oral argument as well as in the briefing on appeal, that the facts contained in the November email were all accurate. So the question then becomes, was the email a half-truth? The Randy W. case cited by Mr. Barron says that a half-truth is one where there's a connection between the information given and the information withheld. In Randy W., there was a letter of recommendation written on behalf of a school administrator, and it extolled, among other things, the school administrator's rapport with students. What it did not disclose was that the school administrator had, in fact, had inappropriate sexual relations with students. So you can't, on the one hand, say you have a good rapport, but on the other hand, withhold information regarding the sexual relationship. The Oklahoma Law Review article, cited by Mr. Barron on pages 549 through 550, talks about the fact that something is not a half-truth merely because negative information of some sort could have been revealed about the speaker. Rather, a half-truth exists only when the undisclosed facts are so directly related to the initial statement that someone receiving that statement would feel seriously misled. And in that law review article, the examples they gave were, for example, if you tell someone that you have a law license, they're a potential client, but you neglect to tell them that your license was revoked. That is a half-truth. If you tell them you got a degree from Georgetown, but you fail to tell them, for example, that because of some administrative error, the degree was taken back. That is a half-truth. There's nothing that was a half-truth in what was told to Mr. Barron about Attorney A.
What about information that your license was suspended, but the suspension was stayed?
In this case, there is no information given to Mr. Barron, either in the November email or otherwise, about the status of Attorney A's licensure. And so, absent false information, or at least misleading information being given about that issue, there's no half-truth. And so in this case, there was no information about that.
It sounds like, though, that you agreed, Ms. Fairless, that if there was just a suspension that hadn't been sustained, then that would have needed to be disclosed. Is that correct?
That would have needed to be disclosed, Your Honor. That is correct, because there's a specific rule that requires that disclosure. And that is Rule 251.28 of the Rules of Attorney Discipline. And what that rule provides is that if your license is suspended without being stayed, or if your license is taken away from you, you are disbarred, you have an obligation to disclose to clients the fact that you no longer have your license. But the rule does not impose any obligation to disclose the reason why you have your license suspended or taken away. And there's no rule, whether in the Rules of Professional Conduct, the Rules of Discipline, or the case law, that imposes that kind of an obligation on a lawyer. There's one case that is even arguably on point, and that is the case of Cleveland. And that is a Georgia case that held that both physicians and other professionals, and that's the holding of the case, and other professionals have no duty to disclose to a client information regarding the attorney's personal life that could, but does not, affect the attorney's ability to practice law. Under Rule 1.16 of the Rules of Professional Conduct, if you have a material impairment in the practice of law, your obligation is to withdraw from representing the client, not to disclose and try to get the client's informed consent. Judge Bronfen in this case specifically found that there was no material impairment. He specifically found that Attorney A had gotten treatment, had been clean and sober, and had done excellent work for all of his clients, including for Barron. The trial court also found that there was no breach of a standard of care. There was no malpractice, and that finding has not been appealed. As the Cleveland court mentioned, if, in fact, whatever is going on in an attorney's personal life, whether it be a divorce, whether it be alcoholism, whether it be depression, whether you just had a bad day, if that impacts your work such that your conduct falls beneath the standard of care, the client has a remedy. The client has the ability to bring a claim for malpractice. If it is impacting your life, you can also, as a client, make a claim or make a complaint to the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel. And they have a procedure in place to protect the public. The reason why the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel exists is for the protection of the public. And under Rule 251.7, in order for them to have even put Attorney A on probationary status, they had to have found, among other things, that, number one, he was not going to put either the courts or the legal profession in disrepute. And number two, that his practicing law was unlikely to harm the public. And they made that determination before they agreed to give him a fully stayed suspension. The system worked exactly as it needed to work in the case of Attorney A. He self-reported, he voluntarily sought treatment, and he was able to get the treatment he needed for his conditions. And he was able to continue to practice law at a very high level. Under the rule that Mr. Barron argues, if an attorney was required to wear that letter on his or her chest, what incentive would that attorney have to do what Attorney A did? The rules encourage attorneys to get help for their problems, and each and every attorney who practices law one day is going to have a problem in their personal life. And it would dissuade lawyers from getting the help that they need if they knew that if a physician or a mental health provider happened to diagnose them with any form of impediment, they would be subjected to the very sort of claim that Mr. Barron is making here against Moy White. It is a completely unworkable standard that was conceded by Mr. Pack in his argument, and Mr. Eisenberg, Mr. Barron's expert on this issue at trial, could not draw any line, either temporally, how long do you have to disclose these facts? Or with respect to the facts that had to be disclosed, all that Mr. Eisenberg could say is, well, I think Attorney A crossed the line. I can't tell you where the line is. How can any client and any lawyer be expected to abide by a rule where the only way to know what the line is to litigate the line? That raises constitutional vagueness concerns, as mentioned by the Cleveland court, and that is not and cannot be the standard. If you have a headache, does that have to be disclosed? If it's a migraine headache, how about that? Does that cross the line? What if you have postpartum depression? What if you have HIV? How do you possibly know what objectively may be considered material or subjectively may be considered material to the client? There's no way that that can be the test. And this court doesn't even need to reach the issue of whether that should be the test, because the court's factual findings in this case mean that there can be no materiality. The court found that Mr. Barron was not credible and discounted entirely all of his testimony regarding Attorney A. And that was the only evidence put before the trial court to suggest that the information contained in the November email was in any way material to Mr. Barron's determination of how to proceed in the case. Absent a factual finding, which doesn't exist here, there can be no affirmance of the trial, or there can be no reversal of the trial court simply based on the lack of materiality. Nor would a reasonable lawyer have viewed this information as material. Under the Cleveland case and the Williams case, This incident simply is not objectively material to the representation. And even the Oklahoma Law Review article cited by Mr. Barron says that courts should not blindly impose a duty of absolute and perfect candor on attorneys to relay information about credentials or experience. A client who hires an attorney has no legitimate expectation that the attorney will divulge every unfavorable fact relating to the attorney's credentials or experience. This court should affirm the trial court based solely on those factual findings without even reaching the issue of duty. The court also can affirm based solely on the factual findings because there's no causation. The Cleveland case in footnote 14 talks for the fact that there must be causation. And the Moats case talks about the fact that there must be a connection between the conduct that's alleged to be unethical and the harm to the client. And the Colorado cases, none of which is factually on point here, also talk about the fact that for a breach of fiduciary duty claim to exist, there has to be causation and there has to be resulting damages, and that's the Adler case.
What is your response to Mr. Pack's argument about forfeiture as a remedy and when that remedy applies that no causation needs to be shown?
Mr. Pack misconstrues both Colorado law as well as the out-of-state cases on which he relies. To begin, there are two Colorado cases that were cited regarding the forfeiture issue. One was the Moore case, where a real estate broker withheld facts regarding the real estate transaction, not regarding his credentials, not regarding his experience. And the withholding of those facts resulted in harm to the client because it decreased the price that the real estate broker's client received. So in Moore, there was actual harm to the client. Moore was a 1990 case. 12 years later, the Colorado Supreme Court decided the Mullins case. And Mullins took a very different approach. Mullins said that even though the attorney in that case had violated an ethical rule by failing to put a contingent fee agreement in writing, that did not warrant disgorgement of fees at all. And what the court said in that case is that it would be inequitable to the lawyer and would give the client an unfair windfall. It would unjustly enrich the client to hold that any ethical violation, no matter how mundane, no matter whether it had a connection to the harm or whether there was any harm, warranted disgorgement. And so under Mullins, Mullins actually supports the view that an ethical violation by itself does not warrant disgorgement. In a footnote in Mullins, it does cite to the restatement section 37, but it cites to the restatement in order to reject an argument that was made in that case by the client, where the client pointed to the restatement as wanting disgorgement. And what the court said in the footnote is, the restatement is inapplicable in this case. The court did not adopt the restatement section 37. But even if the court had adopted that, the outcome here would be precisely the same. There has to be a clear and serious violation. Minor violations are not enough. And even the Oklahoma Law Review article says that non-disclosure of facts is not clear and serious. And the restatement says there are many other factors, including harm. So because, number one, there is no duty, and number two, based on the court's factual findings, this court need not even reach that issue. We ask that this court affirm the trial court and affirm its entry of judgment in favor of Moy White. Thank you, Your Honors.
And thank you, Ms. Fairless.
I would encourage the court to read carefully both the Moore case and the Mullins case, and I think you will find that both of those cases evolve the very proposition that I stated. Specifically, Moore talked about the lack of a requirement of causation or harm where an agent has breached a duty of loyalty. In Mullins, there was no allegation of breach of fiduciary duty in the case, And the footnote, while it supports the proposition of Restatement 37, governing lawyers, it says that it wasn't applicable in the case because there was no breach of fiduciary duty claim. If the court rereads the briefs that we filed, it is quite clear that there is a very substantial difference in remedy and elements when the claim is for compensatory damages as opposed to when the remedy is fee forfeiture. And that is a very important distinction here. Also, there's nothing here that we're trying to change any factual findings. What we are arguing is that the court applied the wrong legal standard. The legal standard that the court applied had to do with revealing personal medical information based upon whether the attorney's condition actually materially impaired his ability to practice law, as opposed to conditions which could impair an attorney's ability to practice law. That is the wrong legal standard. The measure of Moriwhite's duty of disclosure is whether the information that the law firm failed to disclose was material to a reasonable client. And the concept of reasonableness or materiality should not scare this court. Those are concepts which have been in the law and given to the good hands of the courts in terms of judge, jury, the findings of finders of fact in this court of appeals. And I would direct the court to Restatement Second of Torts 538, particularly Section 2B, says that it is not the factual finding here, it's the wrong legal standard. And there's nothing here about putting a scarlet A on an attorney's back. And the Cleveland case and the Auer case have nothing to do here. The Cleveland case is a Georgia statute dealing with informed consent, which says exactly what has to be disclosed. And the court objected to the trial court expanding that requirement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pack. Thank you again to you, Ms. Fairless, and to you, Mr. Peck. We very much appreciate your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.